The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, so before I start, I'm not totally sure I need the mic. I want to say I'm not from West Virginia, but I had the opportunity to be in West Virginia a bit this spring, first for the teacher strike, and then to go back and meet with some other amazing West Virginia class warriors over the course of the last few months. And that's what inspired me to learn more about class struggle in West Virginia, both in the past and today. But I'm not by any means an expert, and I'm not going to be able to cover everything. So what I'm going to talk about is the period through the Mine Wars, which some folks in this room may be familiar with, but I welcome people in the discussion to share more current stories, to talk about their own experiences, also to ask questions. I know we have some folks from Appalachia in the room, so they probably can talk a little bit more about it. So that's just my disclaimer. I will say, somebody asked me the other day, what's the best like kind of starter book if you want to learn more about some of this, and this is the book I would recommend, The Devil is Here in These Hills. It reads like a really great novel, only it's all true, and it's a really good introduction. And then there's a bunch of other books up in the book room. We have a whole table of books about Appalachia history and Appalachia organizing today, so people should go check it out. But this is a good starter one if you're interested in knowing more. All right, so now I'm going to start. So one of the narratives of the mainstream media during the teacher strike was that this was a red state rebellion. And West Virginia as a state voted heavily for Trump, so it must be just a bunch of backwards workers who don't know what's best for them and do things against their own interest. And wow, it's super surprising that they're going on strike, because that seems to go against this narrative. In doing research for this talk, I came across some similar tropes from the narratives of the past. That when the miners in West Virginia resisted and took up arms to rid themselves from the private mine guard system, which was incredibly oppressive, I'm going to talk a lot about that later, many people in other places around the country called them uncivilized and ignored their pleas for solidarity. But I saw a different truth about the workers of West Virginia when I was there. So the narrative of a country split into red, i.e. Republican, and blue Democrat states, or even worse, backwards versus enlightened workers, is not the real dividing line in the story of resistance movements today or those of the past. What has become clear is that rather than backward workers versus enlightened liberal workers, the teacher strike revived the classic battle between the haves and the have-nots, those who make decisions about cutting funding that affects tens of thousands of public sector workers and people living in the state, and those who must live with the very real consequences of these decisions. This is a battle that has long been waged in the hills of West Virginia, most notably in the coal wars between miners and ruthless mine owners. But it is clear from the recent round of strikes that this battle is far from over. We should take inspiration both from the strikes today and the rich history of class struggle that has come before them. There are lessons to be learned from our forebears, lessons we hope to build on now and in the future about how to fight the bosses, how to win, how to wage militant class struggle. So I want to go through some of those, and I want to start by talking about the roots of the rebellion. And I want to talk a little bit about how West Virginia became a state, and the question of slavery and the black population in West Virginia. So that's going to be where I start. So many people know the story of John Brown. If you don't, that's another book you should pick up, and Harper's Ferry. While John Brown was not from West Virginia, Harper's Ferry is technically in West Virginia, eastern West Virginia. It's a little bit of a drive. I tried to go there, but it was too far. We'll make it back at some point. And it was one of the sparks that ignited the war to end slavery. This was, in a way, a harbinger for how the Civil War would split Virginia and lead to the formation of a new state following the Wheeling Conventions of 1861, after the Civil War had begun. Delegates from some Unionist counties of northwestern Virginia decided to break away from Virginia. Although they included secessionist counties in the new state, so there was a break some of the counties still wanted to be part of the Confederacy, some didn't, but a new state was formed in 1861. That state was West Virginia. These delegates were opposed to slavery and secession, but did not necessarily want to have the strong arm of the federal government imposed on them. So there's been this tradition of kind of like anti-state repression that is at the very heart of West Virginia forming as a state. While many West Virginians joined the Union Army, many more took part in self-organized militias that wreaked havoc on neighboring slaveholding states like Kentucky and refused to bow to any centralized government forces, even the Unionists. So again, that rich tradition. And people will tell you stories about this if you ask them. It's really interesting. People are proud of the kind of independent nature of a lot of the resistance, even early on. If the formation of West Virginia as a state is where we begin in this discussion, then it seems appropriate to have a conversation about to what degree the mostly white working class in West Virginia were anti-racist. I think this is one of the debates today. This is a topic often debated today. Sorry, that's in my notes. On one hand, West Virginia joined the Union as a slave... On one hand, West Virginia joined the Union actually as a slave state. However, they did have a timeline for releasing slaves, and it's important to note that the main reason many leaders in West Virginia opposed slavery is because they believed it took away paying jobs from white workers. So even though it was a state that has a rich history of breaking away from Virginia during the Civil War, it wasn't on the ideological basis of opposing slavery. And I think we should just say that because we're trying to tell the real truth here about our own history. On the other hand, the material conditions in West Virginia, especially surrounding the construction of railroads and coal mining, led to more multiracial organizing efforts among workers in West Virginia than almost anywhere else in America at the time. So these two things can be true. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the multiracial organizing, especially among the mine workers, in just a minute. When the Civil War ended, West Virginia pro-Union Republicans in state office inflicted harsh penalties on residents who had been loyal to the Confederacy. Among other restrictions, former Confederates were forbidden from voting or holding public office. In response, the Ku Klux Klan and other racist terrorist organizations advertised in newspapers to gain members during the late 1860s and 1870s. These racist vigilantes directed their vengeance at black workers who were receiving voting rights at the same time former Confederates were losing those same voting rights. So there was a pitting against each other. This became even more heated when Congress ratified the 15th Amendment, giving blacks the right to vote, while an estimated 20,000 white citizens in West Virginia were not allowed to vote because they had supported slavery. Construction of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad in the late 1860s and early 1870s, however, brought many black laborers into southern West Virginia. The C&O Railroad accelerated the development of southern West Virginia's coal industry in the 1870s, creating more jobs and attracting more black workers to the state. The Norfolk and Western Railroad did the same for the southwestern part of the state. McDowell County experienced an influx of migrant workers, increasing its black population from 0.1% in 1880 to 31% in 1910. During that same time, the black population of the entire state increased from 17,000 in 1870 to 64,000 in 1910, reaching nearly 115,000 in 1930. So when you talk about changing dynamics in the working class in West Virginia, I think that's an important one for us to note. The fact that black workers worked alongside white and immigrant workers in the coal mines and the railways created spaces for multiracial solidarity. That workers of all backgrounds had to deal with the same harsh conditions of the mines and company town system made them natural allies and helped to give them help give rise to the mass multiracial movements of the early 1900s. While we should note and celebrate that workers organized across racial and ethnic divisions, much of this was born out of the conditions in which they worked, not necessarily some enlightened consciousness of the workers. And I say that just because, again, I think it's like there's debates about this. And I think it's important that we understand the conditions that led to the solidarity and celebrate it, but also also understand it's not automatic. It wasn't just that there's a group of people who were more anti-racist than other people, and it automatically happened. Mine owners were so angered over this solidarity, they segregated all aspects of miners' lives, housing, education, even church services, but they kept the most right place for collective action integrated, the workplace, the mine colliers. This proved to be enough to build multiracial struggle in the decades after 1900. So I wanted to start there because I think that's an important thing, and I hope people bring it up in the conversation if you have questions or insights on that. Cool. I want to talk a little bit now about the political economy of coal, because the coal industry and the conditions of life for mine workers obviously go together. Let's start back with something I referenced earlier, the railway system. Before the late 1800s, the lack of railways and infrastructure to fully exploit the mineral deposits in West Virginia kept most mining operations small and locally owned. With the massive railway expansion in the 1870s, corporate coal industrialists from outside West Virginia realized now they could not only access the rich coal deposits in the state, but then ship it to other places around the country, particularly the North and Midwest that was beginning to boom in the steel industry and the factories. For example, in 1877, railway expansion up the Kanawha and New River allowed 7 new mining operations to open in a single year. The rise of coal production and the orientation on extracting profit from West Virginia and taking it elsewhere began during this time and has unfortunately continued to this day. This is one of the big fights today about the severance tax, making extraction industries pay, and I'm hoping people will bring that up as well. Coal barons from outside the state moved in droves to West Virginia, set up private mine operations, and in many cases, private coal-owned towns to go with them. By the late 1910s, West Virginia was producing around 90 million tons of coal and employing nearly 100,000 miners. U.S. Steel's coal operation in West Virginia made it its biggest employer. So talk about a rapid change in what the political economy of a state looks like, and then also on the basis of massive extraction of profit. So who were these 100,000 miners? The growing coal industry brought in thousands of migrant workers, immigrants from Italy and Southern Europe, and black workers escaping sharecropping in the Jim Crow South. Blacks made up about 20% of the West Virginia mine workforce during the early 1900s, and Italian immigrants were another 30%. So basically about half the workforce was not native West Virginians. Poor West Virginian farmers who could no longer afford to keep their land because of the coal interests that were gobbling up land in the area also were forced to go to work in the mines. One of these farmers whose family lost their land during this time was a man named Frank Keeney, who I'm going to talk about a little bit more. Hopefully some people may know who he is. He became a trapper when he was 10 years old, and he continued to work in the mines for about a decade. He would later become a major leader of the Mine Workers Union and a real class warrior. So I'll talk about him more later. So what was life like for a coal miner during this time? Because, quote unquote, pioneer, I call them parasitic industrialists, like the kind that came to West Virginia in droves in the late 1800s, operated on a very small profit margin. They were investing a lot in getting their initial operation open. They tried to keep costs as low as possible, and the number one variable cost was labor. So there was this constant downward pressure on wages. Also because transportation costs were higher to get coal from West Virginia to other places, like Pennsylvania, where there was also mining industry, it was a quicker commute for the coal. Folks who ran the mines in West Virginia felt they had to keep costs as low as possible, and so they had the worst labor wages and working conditions in the country. Wages for West Virginia coal miners were often a quarter or more below what their counterparts earned in other parts of the country. This high rate of exploitation compared to other miners would only become more exacerbated as miners around the country became unionized, and most West Virginia miners did not. I'll talk more about this battle for unionization in just a minute. Nearly 80% of the miners at the turn of the century lived in company-owned towns, and the dominance of coal on all aspects of a worker's life took a very heavy toll. When coal operators saw decreased profits, they would not only lower wages, but also raise prices at the company store, which was often the only place workers could buy what they needed to survive: food, household goods, even their required mining equipment. Miners were often paid in something called script, which was only able to be used at the company store and which only returned about 80% when exchanged for actual money like dollars. So basically you were trapped in the system where you had no control over many aspects of your life. The system of complete economic dominance over all aspects of a worker's life further distinguished the mines of West Virginia and their reputation as being one of the most ruthless and controlling work environments in the country. Some black workers even went on to record to say the mine industry was the new form of slavery. And I take that pretty seriously because it came from black workers, some of whom were former slaves, so I don't say that lightly. The miners were not just adults. Boys as young as 8 years old worked as trappers and were paid from 75 cents to $1.25 a day. Miners who picked the coal would receive 40 cents for each ton they mined. In West Virginia, they were often required to mine what was called a long ton, which was actually 2,240 pounds. 240 pounds, for those of you who are not math people, that's 240 pounds more than an actual ton in order to get paid for a ton. So this basically like rigging the system so you have to work harder to get your wage. Many families, both men and boys, had to work just to make ends meet. Even if a family wanted a child to attend school, it was simply impossible to give up the wages they might earn. Thus, many families became generationally trapped in the stranglehold of the mine industry. Unable to put away any money because of debts owed to the company for rent and provisions, and forced to send all their family members who were able to work in the mines, life became a test of endurance and, in many cases, a battle just to survive. And there are stories like Frank Keeney's family was one of the families that tried to move away. His family ended up contracting smallpox. They lost their farm and had to move back. And they were in an independent coal town, or a town that wasn't owned by the coal company. And when they moved back, they had to move to a coal town. And he said just the difference between being owned by the mine, basically, versus having your own house. And it's just a very gut-wrenching, tragic story for many of these families. Added to these conditions of exploitation and oppression were the real health dangers and deadly accidents inherent to the mine industry, especially one as unregulated as West Virginia mines were at this time. Even though they were both federal and state laws outlining safety protocols, most mine owners simply ignored these laws. On December 6, 1907, the Fairmount Coal Company's interconnected number 6 and 8 mines at Monongah? Somebody from West Virginia help me? Sure. The mine exploded, killing as many as 400 miners. It's considered the deadliest mine accident in U.S. history. This did not incentivize coal operators to change their practices. To give you a sense of how dangerous conditions continued to be, an estimated 4,260 miners were killed in mining accidents in West Virginia between 1910 and 1920. 580 of these deaths were attributed to massive explosions and fires. So these were not like people just dying of inhaling fumes. These were like mines exploding and people going to work every day in those kinds of conditions. These conditions of life as a miner created massive anger, hopelessness, and widespread feelings of being trapped. However, underneath this desperation grew a growing sentiment of resistance, and it would inspire the battles to come in the early 1900s as workers raised demands for a union, for better wages, for dignity on the job, and for safe working conditions. These harsh conditions also created space for solidarity among miners of different backgrounds who had to work collectively just to make it out safely each and every day from their workplace. So now I want to add one small piece to this description of what life was like in the mining industry at the turn of the century in West Virginia. I've recently begun to read a little bit more about an ongoing debate, first raised in the 1970s, but getting a new audience today, about whether Appalachia fits within a model of colonization when we talk about the development of different states. The proponents of this colonial model counterpose it to the culture of poverty models that describe Appalachia as underdeveloped, uncivilized, and situate the social and economic hardships of the region as being the fault of its own citizens' backwardness. So the people who put this forward are putting forward an idea of colonization as a counter-argument to the kind of hillbilly elegy bullshit that people put out there now, that there's a culture of poverty and backwardness that's always been, and that's where things like the opioid crisis come from in West Virginia. Just people just don't know how to operate in a civilized world. It's disgusting. So this internal colony model, I think, is a very intriguing theory. So that's why I wanted to present it here. I hope people can talk about it a little more in the discussion. Helen Lewis, who is one of the first people who theorized this, argues in the introduction to her book on this topic, Colonialism in Modern America, The Appalachian Case, This is a quote from her. "The perspective which we select examines the process through which dominant outside industrial interests establish control, exploit the region, and maintain their dominance and subjugation. Appalachia is a good example of colonial domination by outside interests. Its history also demonstrates the concerted efforts of the exploiters to label their work as progress and to blame any of the obvious problems it causes on the ignorance or deficiencies of the Appalachian people themselves." So I think that's something people can take up, whether they think that's an interesting, useful theory or not. To what degree people agree with this model is a topic for ongoing debate. I do think it's better than Hillbilly Elegy's model, and I definitely think it's better than the culture of poverty model that blames people for the social problems that they deal with. Okay. Well, that's perfect. 20 minutes, and I'm at 20 minutes. I'm going to talk shit. Okay. Sorry. I tend to not stay on time. Okay. So now I want to talk about some of the early struggles in the fight for unionization and get to the class struggle part of this. That was all kind of laying the groundwork. One of the challenges facing West Virginia workers was that they were the last major coal-producing state to gain union rights. There were several reasons for this. One, the coal operators in West Virginia hired ruthless private armed guards, predominantly from a group called the Baldwin-Felts Agency, which you can go boo. Think of them as like the Pinkertons of West Virginia, if you're familiar with them and the Homestead Strike. The Baldwin-Felts Agency brutally repressed all organizing efforts and basically murdered people. Another obstacle was that the National Union, the United Mine Workers of America, did not consistently prioritize organizing in West Virginia. They kind of had a in and we'll try and ooh, it got hard and then they left. So there was an inconsistent support from the National Union at different points, particularly when struggle got really intense. And so I would say that's also one of the factors. Though leading organizers like Mother Jones came to give speeches and support union drives in West Virginia, the mine workers were an unreliable ally in some cases when it came to sending resources to West Virginia, and the miners in West Virginia continued to lag behind their counterparts in places like the Ohio Valley, the Allegheny mining regions, and Colorado, which also experienced some brutal mine wars of their own. And so this meant that wages, working conditions, hours, all of these things, the long ton, they lasted in West Virginia longer than in other mining regions. Ordinary West Virginia miners persisted, however, in their organizing efforts, and ultimately after more than three decades of warfare with the bosses, and I mean warfare, we're going to talk about it, were finally able to win full union rights in the 1930s. So I want to take a few minutes now to talk about some of these struggles and the lessons they can teach us all. And they're not all happy stories, but I think they teach us a lot about resilience and resistance and what it's going to take down the system. One of the first mass miner strikes in West Virginia came in solidarity with the Great Coal Strike of 1902 that actually began in eastern Pennsylvania. The miners of West Virginia were excited by the newly organized United Mine Workers of America, and 16,000 West Virginia miners shut down 408 collieries on June 7, 1902, about a month after the strike had begun in Pennsylvania. So their first strike was actually a solidarity strike, which is kind of cool. The coal owners responded to the strikers by evicting miners from their company houses and filing court injunctions against them. Union members were beaten and shot by private detectives from the Baldwin-Felts Agency, and thousands of miners were added to a blacklist that meant they would never be able to work in the state again. In response, striking miners engaged in street battles with both Baldwin-Felts guards and scab workers who were trying to reopen the mines. Ultimately, the governor sent in 400 militiamen into the New River coal fields to assist in keeping the mines open and stopping the violence against the scab workers. Despite these heroic efforts, the New River coal field miners could not secure their union rights. They did, however, win some pay increases, even though they still lagged far behind their counterparts in the northern part of the country. And the Baldwin-Felts agents continued to institute a reign of terror on any workers caught trying to organize a union. For nearly a decade, this first mass strike would be remembered as simply a victory for the mine owners. But later on, the struggle came to be seen as a dress rehearsal for another fight that would take place on a much larger scale. For those of you who know, of course, I'm here referring to the mine wars that began in 1912 and continued for nearly a decade. So I want to talk a little bit about the first mine war, 1912 to 1918, and the second mine war, which began in 1920. And these were wars. I think it's completely apt to say these were wars. Because of the brutal repression of the coal miners, of the coal owners, and the lack of consistent support from the National Mine Workers Union, nearly 90% of West Virginia miners remained ununionized in 1912. Rank and file militants like Frank Keeney wanted to do something about that. United Mine Workers of America had a strong, if isolated, presence in the Paint Creek area, which is located in the Kanawha Valley, which is about a dozen miles from Charleston, which is the capital, and most miners there were unionized. In March of 1912, Paint Creek miners who were part of the union attempted to renegotiate their contracts for higher pay and automatic union dues being detracted from their paychecks in order to be more aligned with the contract, with the contracts of their counterparts and other locals around the country. In response, the majority of Paint Creek mine owners withdrew their recognition of the union and evicted the miners from their homes. On April 18, 1912, union and non-union miners from Paint Creek, as well as 7,500 miners from the previously non-union Cabin Creek, Kanawha, and Fayette counties, went on strike. The United Mine Workers of America set up tent camps for miners and their families who had been evicted. This is, again, something else that is common, that comes up in all of these. When miners are evicted, they have to go find land that isn't owned by the coal companies. They erect tents. Living in a tent in the dead of winter is pretty serious stuff. And people did that, in some cases, living in tents for years in order to remain on strike. United Mine Workers of America Vice President Frank Hayes and Mother Jones visited the state to pledge their support, but did not send any strike funds to the region. So remember I said there was inconsistent support from the National Union? There were several cases where they asked the United Mine Workers of America to send money, and they were like, we're unable to do that because we're busy organizing in Colorado or Pennsylvania, where they were having more success, but it still kind of speaks to some of the inconsistent support. Not wanting to remain closed indefinitely, the mining companies in the Paint Creek area hired strikebreakers and more than 300 Baldwin Felts agents to suppress the strike. Striking miners and their families were also prohibited from using company bridges and roads, as well as utilizing things like running water. So when I say they owned all aspects of someone's life, they were literally like, and I want people to take a minute and just think about some of the connections here between what's happening in Palestine today and some of the stories of the West Virginia mine wars, because I don't want to make too much of a literal connection, but I think there are some things about, like, it's illegal for you to be in your own town, use the road, cross the street, drink this water. Those are the kinds of conditions people's faced. Company guards killed several miners over the first few weeks of the strike and constructed a machine gun equipped armored train known as the Bull Moose Special, which they used to fire upon the tent camps of the striking workers mostly at night. So they would drive through the camps on the train and just open fire. And you see these pictures of tents with bullet holes and little children standing outside with bullet casings that they had found outside their tent in the morning. So people were just killed indiscriminately. It's documented that dozens of unarmed miners and their families were injured and killed during this struggle by armed guard-led raids into these encampments. Feeling they had no choice, miners, with the help of the Socialist Party, which I'm going to talk about more in just a minute, acquired weapons and defended themselves against the mining company guards. So this idea that, like, West Virginia miners were violent and, like, took up arms against the state, it's like they were shot at in their tents at night, and they decided to arm themselves in order to try to survive. And that's the narrative I think we need to come back to, because it's often misrepresented. And this led to open armed class warfare across the Kanawha Valley. After months of armed combat, in September 1912, West Virginia Governor William E. Glasscock declared martial law, sent in 1,200 state troopers and National Guardsmen, and confiscated weapons and ammunition from the miners, and attempted to enforce law and order on the strike zone. While the declaration of martial law did reduce armed conflict in the winter of 1912 and 1913, it did nothing to abate the underlying causes of the violence, and the conflict continued, albeit with fewer instances of direct armed conflict. So they took away the guns, but it didn't solve the problem, and people were still fighting. Miners and their families continued to starve in tent villages, and mine owners continue to try to bring in scab labor to keep the mines open. The governor ordered National Guardsmen to arrest hundreds of miners. They kept them locked in a railway freight house in Pratt, West Virginia, awaiting military tribunals. They were charged as military combatants and were held without bail, without charges, without representation for months. Clearly, the state government was not on the side of the strikers, and it became obvious to the miners they could not hold out indefinitely against such pressures. Finally, in April of 1913, United Mine Workers officials presented the Paint Creek Mining Companies with a compromise deal, leaving out some of the demands of the miners, but maintaining support for a 9-hour workday, accountability for miner compensation, and protection from backlash for union membership. After nearly a full year of work stoppages and fighting, the mining companies accepted the compromise proposal, which was enforced by West Virginia state soldiers who continued to occupy the area for months after the strike. Out of this struggle, worker leaders like Frank Keeney learned some important things about the ruthlessness of the mine owners and the utter lack of support from the state government and at times their own union leadership, especially nationally. Many labor militants took to the politics of the Socialist Party during this time in West Virginia as an alternative to both the Democrats and the Republicans who consistently sided with the interests of big business. In fact, the Socialist Party made major gains in registered membership during this period of struggle. And by 1914, several thousand West Virginians were dues-paying members of local Socialist Party branches. In 1910, local socialists began to elect candidates to office, and in 1912, more than 15,000 West Virginians cast their ballots for socialist presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs. The progress that West Virginia socialists achieved on the electoral front was a reflection of the shift in workers' consciousness to the left, and workers abandoning the idea that politicians would somehow bring them justice and a fair way of life. U.S. entry into World War I would split the socialist movement in West Virginia like it split the socialist movement pretty much everywhere else in the country. But we can't forget that for that moment, there were a lot of people who were actually breaking into more radical politics. In addition to becoming a Socialist Party organizer, Frank Keeney had learned firsthand that support from the National Mine Workers Union would be inconsistent at best, and that West Virginia needed local, strong union leadership and militant bases of workers in order to take down the coal bosses. Particularly those coal bosses in southern West Virginia, where some of the worst worker abuses were taking place. He ran for and won presidency of the United Mine Workers of America District 17, representing unionized miners across the state. So this sets the stage for the most famous era of class struggle in West Virginia history, the Mine Wars of 1920 to 22. Everyone must remember that between the earlier strikes in 1912 and the second round of mine wars was World War I, which massively increased the demand for coal. So it's important to look at some of the political economy of what happens between the two mine wars in the state. Workers and unions, for the most part, put aside their class antagonisms and worked with the coal companies to produce coal needed to fuel the U.S. war efforts. There's a lot of like patriotic posters and stuff you can see in the Mine Wars Museum of things that were done during the period of World War I to try to like quell some of the labor unrest. After the war, mine workers believed they would be rewarded for their hard work and loyalty during World War I, while mine owners, who saw a huge drop in demand for coal and coal prices, sought to put the squeeze back on their workers. In spring of 1920, hundreds of fed-up miners in Matewan, located in Mingo County, which is in the southern part of West Virginia, decided to join the United Mine Workers of America. In retaliation, the Burnwell Coal and Coke Company fired all union miners and gave them 3 days to leave their company-owned houses. Despite the evictions, miners in Mingo County continued to join the union. A May 6, 1920 United Mine Workers meeting drew over 3,000 members. And if anybody's familiar with the population of the state, that's a mass meeting. It's a mass meeting on any scale, but it's like pretty much everyone was there. By May 17, 1920, the United Mine Workers of America had set up a tent colony for evicted miners outside of Matewan. On May 19, 1920, 13 agents of the Baldwin-Felts Detective Agency, boo, terrible people, they're the villains in this, returned to Matewan to evict more miners. The Baldwin-Felts agents were challenged by Matewan Police Chief Sid Hatfield and Matewan Mayor Cable Testerman. People should talk more about Sid Hatfield, especially as he is kind of like a heroic folk figure. And he's actually a police officer who did the right thing. So people who know more can talk about him. they challenged the Baldwin Felt agent's authority in the town. They basically said, evicting people from our town, like, you don't have any legal right to do that. Baldwin Felt's agents persisted and carried out their evictions under the watch of a crowd of miners and their families who had gathered. Hearing of the trouble stirring in May 1, miners from surrounding areas armed themselves and made their way to the town. As the Baldwin Felt's agents were headed to the train station to leave May 1 on the evening of May 19th, they were confronted once more by Police Chief Sid Hatfield and the mayor. Both Hatfield and the Baldwin Felt's agent, Albert Feltz, reported that they had warrants for each other's arrest. So it's it's kind of funny, but it's like, these are true stories, so I feel like it's a little bit like a soap opera drama, like, you're arrested, no, you're arrested, who has authority? But they did, like, have basically a showdown in the town, and a shootout began between Hatfield and the Felt's agents, and was quickly joined by the armed miners who had come to the town to support the strikers. The shootout resulted in 10 dead. Mayor Testerman, 2 miners, and 7 Baldwin Felt's agents, including Baldwin Felt's agency chief Thomas Felt's younger brothers, Albert and Lee. So that's important to note that his 2 brothers were killed, because he becomes kind of rabid in going after the miners after this. Support for unionization in Mingo County increased after the May 1 shooting. By July 1st, 1920, the majority of miners in the county had unionized and joined the strike. Miners and mine guards engaged in several armed conflicts over the closure of the coal mines and access to rail routes in the summer and fall of 1920. The West Virginia government declared martial law and sent in federal troops to quell the strike, but backed down under threat of general strike by all coal miners in West Virginia. So people learned some stuff from the first round. When they try to send in state troops, they're like, oh, do you want the whole state on strike? Because that's what you're provoking right now. An angry Thomas Felt hired a team of lawyers to prosecute a case against Sid Hatfield and 15 other miners who were alleged to have participated in the May 1 shootout, specifically on the charge of murdering Albert Felt. All 16 men were, however, acquitted by a Mingo County jury. Shortly thereafter, the West Virginia state legislature passed a bill allowing criminal cases to be prosecuted with jurors from other counties. So they were like, we're never going to convict them in Mingo. We should be able to try them in other places. Murder charges were renewed, only this time for the deaths of the other 6 Baldwin Felt's agents, and the trials were moved outside of Mingo County. Sid Hatfield and his deputy, Ed Chambers, were also brought up on charges of destroying a mining camp in McDowell County. And on August 1st, 1921, Hatfield, Chambers, and their wives traveled unarmed to the McDowell County Courthouse to stand trial. Upon reaching the courthouse, Hatfield and Chambers were shot and killed in cold blood by waiting Baldwin Felt's agents. And I know it seems like I'm going, like, very detailed on this. These things are things that are important sparks for some of what happens later. So they were murdered in cold blood because they couldn't be convicted in court. Miners in West Virginia were outraged at the deaths of Sid Hatfield and Ed Chambers, who in many ways had become heroes in the struggle. The murder of one of their heroes without any recourse was the final spark needed to ignite the flame of all-out class war across the state. In the weeks following the August 1st assassinations, thousands of miners organized and armed themselves across West Virginia. Beginning in late August of 1921, miners began rallying at Lenz Creek, which is approximately 10 miles south of Charleston. Estimates of total numbers vary, but on August 24th, between 10,000 and 20,000 miners began marching from Lenz Creek into Logan County in order to force the southern mining counties to recognize the Union and to end the mine guard system and the war of terror it had wreaked on families. Many of the miners were armed, and many had gained combat experience from being soldiers and fighting in World War I. So not only were they armed, but they also knew how to shoot guns. In response to the armed march of miners, Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin, another villain in this story, assembled a force of approximately 2,000 county police, state police, and state militia, and Baldwin Felt's agents to stop the marching miners in the mountain range surrounding Logan County. On August 25th, the miners began arriving in the mountains surrounding Logan, and fighting began. Though Sheriff Chafin commanded fewer men, they were equipped with machine guns and privately rented aircraft that dropped, like, makeshift bombs on the miners that were basically filled with shrapnel. It's disgusting. So even though they had fewer people, people fighting. They had more intense weaponry. On August 30th, 1921, President Warren G. Harding declared martial law for the entire state of West Virginia. And 2,500 federal troops arrived on September 2nd, bringing with them machine guns and military aircraft in order to quell the strike, or the march. Facing this large and well-equipped fighting force, the miners were forced to stand down and retreat. Approximately 550 miners and labor activists were convicted of murder, insurrection, and treason for their participation in the march from Lenz Creek to Logan County and the ensuing what is now called the Battle of Blair Mountain. The battle ended in defeat for the pro-union miners, and the United Mine Workers membership in West Virginia dropped by about half between 1921 and 1924. However, in the national press, there were some small victories for the mine workers. Stories of the brutality of the mine owners and the conditions of the workers got printed in outlets across the country, and many people around the world felt solidarity with the plight of the West Virginia miners for the first time. Okay, I'm in my wrap-up now. So, unfortunately, I wasn't able to go into more detail of the struggles that have happened since, but I want to talk just to frame in my conclusion, the 1930s, the aftermath of the mine wars, and the stories of the struggle today. So one could look at what happened and say that the courageous fights of the West Virginia miners in the early 1900s ended in brutal defeat and wasn't worth the lives and bloodshed it cost. I think it's important to understand that when people facing tremendous oppression and inequality resist, even if they don't win, it means something. It means they have not been broken. We see some of this same courageous resistance in the battles taking place in places like Palestine and Syria today, where you can't say it's a completely hopeful struggle, but it's a struggle of courage and resistance and not being bowed. People stand up against injustice, even though they face massive violence from their oppressors. The West Virginia mine workers and their families, despite being terrorized by armed mine guards, despite being abandoned for the most part by their national union, and despite losing major strikes for union rights, never gave up. Their bravery and resilience in the face of repression and isolation is inspiring, and we should tell their stories today in order to honor those struggles. These losing battles laid the groundwork for the union recognition and better working conditions that were won in the 1930s. It also laid the groundwork for future mine strikes, the Black Lung Strike of 1969 that brought about federal legislation to battle this deadly disease, this deadly and preventable disease. The Wildcat Strikes of 1977 and 78 that tried to wrest the United Mine Workers of America from a model of concessionary business unionism. And the Pits and Coal Strike of 1989 and 90 that won health care and pensions for miners who were being told that when they retired, they would have no health care or pensions. One could even say it helped build a foundation for the teacher strikes of both 1990 and 2018. These struggles of the past continue to influence the struggles of today in West Virginia. The continued battle over the extraction industry, tax the rich campaigns, and the fight for health care funding are linked to the resistance that has come before. Today in West Virginia, the power of the United Mine Workers of America has been much diminished. From 100,000 union members in 1950 to less than 15,000 coal miners left in the state now, only half of them unionized. This shift in the balance of class forces over the past few decades means the coal industry can continue its plunder of West Virginia unless we rebuild serious militant class fight back. This is why the resistance of teacher and education workers, union and non-union together, leading militant struggles, demanding the extraction industry pay for what it has done, is so important. We must honor the fighters who came before, but also learn from their struggles in a very dynamic way. We have to learn that we cannot rely on the politicians or even our own union leadership to lead the fight for us. We must do it for ourselves, no matter what it takes. As MLK said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. History, like the rich arc of struggle and class resistance in West Virginia, shows us there is no substitute for the organized power of workers liberating themselves.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.